Hello, and welcome to another virtual author program at the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. I'm John Charles, and I'm delighted to have with us today two extremely talented authors, Anna Lee Huber and Alyssa Maxwell. Before I turn things over to questions with the ladies, I do have a brief commercial message. If you enjoy hearing about these authors' books and would like to purchase them today, we encourage you to either go online to the Poison Pen Bookstore or give us a call, and we'll be happy to send either of these authors or both of these authors' books out to you. Now, without further ado, welcome Anna and Alyssa.
Hi, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, John. And thank you, everyone who's here watching, listening.
My first question for you is, tell us about your lives before you became best-selling authors. And why don't we start with you, Anna?
Sure. So I always wrote as a child. I had my own little gang of like Nancy Drew sleuths that I wrote. And I kind of got away from it when I was a teenager. I really focused more on music and stuff. And I went to college for music. And in college, you know how it's so hard to really get any recreational reading in. You're just doing all your assignments. And so I got out of college and I was kind of a little bit unsure of what I wanted to do. I had done classical music training and so vocal. And so really to go on with that, you have to get a master's. And I wasn't sure, do I really want to do that? Do I want to try something else? So I decided to take a year off and I started reading again. And I started reading mystery novels. And I just fell in love again with stories. And I thought, you know, I'm going to give this a try. And at the time, I was just working kind of as an administrative assistant at an insurance office. And really, it was a Memorial Day weekend. It was a 3-day weekend. I gave myself permission to just write for the whole weekend and just see what would happen. And basically, I haven't looked back. And, you know, it took me 7 years to get published, but I was working, you know, jobs as like an administrative assistant that whole time until, you know, and then even after I got published until I was, you know, well along my way. So.
Alyssa?
You know, I think you and I started off really in a similar way because as a kid, I was always writing, you know, the same thing, diaries and letters to friends and little short stories. I loved it. And I knew at a very young age that I wanted to be a writer. Majored in English in college, got out, worked for a little reference book company when I moved down here to Florida. So I really was always focused on some form of writing. But at that company, at that reference book company, one of my good friends published her first book. 1 year. And it's something clicked in me. I realized you don't have to be this amazing rock star type person to write a book. I mean, I had always read people like Mary Stewart, Agatha Christie, of course, Daphne du Maurier. And to me, these people were like goddesses, you know, gods and goddesses. But then seeing a friend succeed that way really taught me that, you know, I think maybe I could do it. And I really threw myself into writing after my first daughter was born because I decided to stay home for a while. And this is what I did during nap time and, you know, anytime I could. And also like you, Anna, it took me a good 7-8 years and several manuscripts to sell my first book. And those are romances. Those were historical romances at the time. And, you know, just several years ago, I decided to switch over to mystery because I think I was a closet mystery writer all along. And it's just worked out and I love it.
Let's talk about the books that brought you here today. Anna, that would be A Pretty Deceit. And Alyssa, it would be, and I'm blanking, Murder at the King's Cot. Why don't we start with you, Alyssa?
It's Murder at King's Cot. And yes, and my sleuth, Emma Cross, is a distant cousin of the Vanderbilts, and she's been born and raised in Newport, Rhode Island. She's a journalist. She writes a society column, at least in the early part of the series. And in Murder at King's Cot, something brand new has come to Newport. The rich, the Vanderbilts and all of those people have decided to bring their motor cars onto the island. And in 1899, this was a big deal. Most people probably had never seen one. So there's a parade that day and the cars are decked out in beautiful florals and fantastical scenes. And everyone's having a wonderful time. That evening, though, someone is struck and eventually dies from one of these cars. And the son of the woman who owns King's Cove is held to blame. Emma does not believe it's him based on certain things that happen when the individual is struck. And so she sets out to prove who actually did, who was driving the car at the time of the accident.
Alyssa, your series sleuth is kind of unique because she has a foot in both worlds. She's kind of connected to the Vanderbilts and the upper crust, but she's a working woman in one sense, and she kind of has connections to the main class. Can you talk a little bit about her?
Yeah, I decided to do that so that Emma would be able to travel from, you know, from one world to the other. She is not entirely accepted by the wealthy class. Outside of the Vanderbilt family, she's treated like a second class type of person. But even so, she can get into their houses and into their social events. But she is also enough of a Newporter that she can talk to the local people, and they accept her, and a lot of them respect her. So this really gives her an opportunity to do her sleuthing all over the place, all over the island. She knows it like the back of her hand. She gets her strength from the bedrock of Aquidneck Island. So she's very much a Newporter. She has that New England work ethic, and she has a sense of community involvement. She takes in women who are down on their luck, or maids who've been fired, have been taken advantage of, and now they've been fired from their position. She takes them into her home. She helps them get back on their feet, and, you know, gives them a new start. And that plays a part in Murder at King's Cove in a very big way, especially toward the end of the book. Emma does something really risky for her, but you know, very important for another character.
Anna, tell us a little bit about Pretty Deceit.
Yeah, sure. So my heroine, Verdi Kent, she was a Secret Service agent during the war. The series takes place just after World War I. And in the fourth book in the series, at this point, she and her husband are trying to make their marriage work, and she has kind of come across her arch nemesis kind of figure in book three. He's kind of sort of my Moriarty figure for this series, Lord Ardmore. And so they're still pursuing proof to prove that he's this nefarious man, that he's been treasonous during the war and all these things. But they need the proof because he's very high up. He has all these connections. And so they're pursuing that. And then she is asked by her father to visit her father's sister, her aunt. Her aunt's estate in Wiltshire was used as it housed officers for the Royal Flying Corps and later the Royal Air Force during the war, because it's right near an airfield there. And this was done a lot. I know a lot of people from Downton Abbey have seen that, like, manor houses were used for hospitals and things like that, but they were also used to store items and also to house military units, especially officers. And sometimes these officers didn't take very well good care of these manor homes. And that's the case here. And she's called in, they're called in to help her with that. But also there's artwork that's gone missing. There's a maid that suddenly disappeared. There's a couple things that are just not adding up. So they're called in to investigate, and a servant is found murdered. And so that kind of sets off that side of the mystery. And it's sort of a two-pronged mystery of finding this proof for Ardmore and investigating these doings at her aunt's estate. So,
Anna, you've said that you wanted to write the Verity Kent series as a way to honor kind of the female spies of World War I. To be honest, I couldn't imagine there were so many women that did that. Tell us a little bit about them.
Absolutely, yeah. So when I always wanted to write a World War I series, but I needed a hook. And I was researching about the Secret Service, and I discovered in the late 90s and the early 2000s, they declassified all these documents. And most people, when they think of World War I and they think of women spies, they think of Mata Hari, or they think of Edith Cavell, the nurse, and that's it. Nobody knows anything else. But it came about from these papers. It was revealed that there were thousands of women who worked in the various agencies in Britain and in the resistance networks in the German occupied areas in Belgium and France. They weren't necessarily British citizens, but they were working for the British as spies and gathering intelligence. And most of these women, like most people, had no idea they existed. And when these documents were declassified, I mean, you could read newspaper articles where people discovered their great grandmother was a Secret Service agent during World War I, and she told no one because they were supposed to keep their mouths shut, and they did. And it was just fascinating to read about all these women and read about the things they did. There was a few memoirs that came out. We knew of a few. In the 20s, it was pretty, their memoirs and things were pretty popular, just the sparse number of them. But then they fell out of existence. Like, they fell out of print, they fell out of interest to society, and so we forgot about them. And then, you know, restudying those women and then the vast amount more of them, it was just fascinating. I really wanted people to know about these women's service and all that they did. Even this, you know, even just working in an office in Britain, you know, they were doing their bit to make, you know, the world better, to win the war and all that. So, and there was a whole broad range of things they did. So it was really interesting to me, and I really wanted to shed light on them and give them that credit.
Alyssa, your Gilded Newport books are set in the Gilded Age. And I think I read somewhere that you described that as conspicuous consumption and social
competition.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit, for those of us that don't know anything about the Gilded Age, what was it like, that world?
Well, you had the people like the Vanderbilts, the Astors, the Rockefellers, the Morgans, and these are the people that were driving industry. You know, with the railroads and steel production and banking and real estate. And they were just snowballing basically in money, and their wealth was just beyond all proportion. Their job was to make the money, secure the power, and establish the dynasty. The women's role was to spend the money in such a way that everybody saw how wealthy their husbands were. And that's where the social competition really comes in, and the conspicuous consumption. No one built a house or drove a coach or wore a gown without the idea behind it that everyone is gonna see me and they're gonna know that I am the Mrs. Vanderbilt, the Mrs. Astor. It was very important to have that kind of status in those days. And they were constantly one-upping each other, trying to outdo each other, and, you know, just basically circling their wagons to keep the rest of society out and themselves in. Another big part of social competition, especially toward the late 1890s, were the whole idea of the million dollar heiresses. People like Consuelo Vanderbilt, or earlier Jenny Jerome, who was actually one of the first. She married one of the Churchills into the Churchill family and was the mother of Winston Churchill. But the one thing that the Gilded Age did not have was true aristocracy, and that was their way of glomming on to that whole idea, was to marry their daughters to usually impoverished aristocracy in Europe. And, you know, the higher the title, the better for the entire family. And those women would, you know, now go to their soiree or whatever kind of party. And yes, my daughter, the Duchess, my daughter, the Princess, my daughter, the Countess. And it was very important to them.
Many of the books in the Gilded Age series are set at actual places, actual homes. Can you talk a little bit about how you decide how to choose a particular place? And I love the fact that they call these places cottages when they're like 400 rooms or something.
Well, you know what? A lot of them don't have 400 rooms. The Breakers is very large. Marble House, on the other hand, really is not all that big. There is only one guest room. At Marble House, because the assumption was anybody else coming to visit had their own cottage. But anyway, the way I chose them was sometimes the house itself and sometimes a combination of the family and the house. So starting with the Breakers was a very easy decision. The Vanderbilts are the most recognizable name from the Gilded Age, I think, even more so than Astor, even though Astor at the time was the premier family. The Breakers is the most ornate and one of the largest houses in Newport. And usually, as soon as people arrive in Newport, if they have only an hour or two to spend there, they go to the Breakers. So again, I have the most recognizable family and the most recognizable house in Newport. And that seemed to me the perfect way to begin the series. And in 1895, when I do begin the series, the Breakers was brand new. It had just been rebuilt from a previous house that burned down. It was their first party where I set my story and the coming out party for their daughter, Gertrude. Now later, I chose houses such as Kingscote, which is a much smaller house than the Breakers or Oakley Court or the Elms. But I had actually had requests from people who have gone to Kingscote, fell in love with it, or Chateau Sumer is another one. Took the tour, fell in love, and really wanted to see the house have a little bit more notoriety, perhaps. Now, when I started Kingscote, I knew nothing about the family. I had visited there and seen the house and how beautiful it was, but I really knew nothing about the family. And maybe we'll get into a little bit more of that later. I don't know if you're gonna ask us about what kind of research we do and the surprises that we find. So maybe I'll save some of that for later. But in this case, I chose the house. In other times, I'll choose the family. In Murder at Crossways, I love the character of Mamie Fish. She was irreverent. She was a loudmouth. She was funny. She was a practical joker. And I knew that she would make a fabulous sidekick for Emma in that book. And I had a blast writing it.
Let's take a moment and talk about research. How do you go about recreating that sense of place and period and time in your books? What kind of sources do you use? I know, Anna, you mentioned somewhere that Tommy's Dictionary of the Trenches was a copy. Maybe you can explain that to readers what that is, but talk a bit about sources and maybe unexpected things that come up when you're doing research. And we'll start with you, Anna.
Yeah, sure. So when I first start a series in a different time period, it's really a deep dive. I mean, you have to know everything. You have to know the history of the era and all the social history and the clothing and the food. And I mean, every little minuscule detail. And then for each book, you kind of delve deeper into different areas. And for my book, I had to do a lot of research on World War I, just general history, understanding the war, and then understanding the impact after the war. And the way, you know, the way the economy was fumbling and all these things, the politics. And then I love, my favorite resources are memoirs and diaries and letters, because they're just invaluable. Especially, I find the language is so important. Like, there's always a rhythm and a cadence and a dialect almost to every era, and especially for the late 1919 and 1920. I mean, you're really getting into that slang, and it's wonderful. And you read these letters and you can just hear it in their voices. And so being able to recreate that, and then also even the, you know, like you mentioned, the Tommy's Dictionary of the Trenches, there was so much slang that came out of the trenches that the men used, and they still used to some extent when they came back into society. The upper class men maybe wouldn't have used it, you know, as much with women in company and all that kind of thing, but it was there, and the women even, you know, came to know it, and we use words now that they used. And so and it's also just kind of fun to read these entries. I mean, like, they called the German Emperor guy, they called him Big Willie. I mean, like, it was so irreverent. It was just funny. And, you know, those kind of things, it's just invaluable to be able to capture the era of that time. And I also was, my favorite way to find a good resource that I've discovered is looking at the bibliography of other books. So there's a research book called Female Intelligence, written by Tammy Proctor, which was a fabulous book. It's all about women's British intelligence in particular in the World War One and before that. It examines the social impact and all of that. And in the back in that bibliography, I stumbled across this memoir written by Captain Henry Landau. And he was the he was in charge of the military section of British intelligence in Rotterdam, Holland during the latter part of the war. So he ran all of the resistance networks within the German occupied areas, including La Dame Blanche, which is the one that I highlight the most. And he gave all these anecdotes and he talked about how it was set up and all these different people and like how the network worked. And it was just such a great resource, which I never could have found, you know, without, I never would have known all that information. So anyway, so that was one of my favorite resources, but firsthand material is absolutely the best, the best.
Well, I have to go back. I actually started researching Newport in colonial era because I needed to know how Newport got to this point where these wealthy families just descended on it and decided to make it their enclave. So I started with, you know, as I said, the colonial era. I went through the early part of the 1800s, the federal period, when the Southerners were coming and they were escaping the heat from the South, and then the Civil War came and so they left and they were not able to come back because most of them lost their money. And so, you know, I went really decade by decade to get a real picture of how Newport came to be what it was. And what's so great about Newport, though, is that you can actually visually see, you can go there and see each of these stages because it's all still there. You see the colonials on the point by the harbor and the more federal buildings that were built later, and then the Gilded Age, the Victorians, you know, the Gothic revivals, the shingle style and the stick style, and then finally those palazzos and chateaus that were built in the 1880s and 1890s. One of my really favorite sources are newspapers, archived newspapers that I, you know, I'm able to access online. I have found those minute little details only by pouring through articles. For instance, I could not figure out where the original Newport Polo Grounds were. It was driving me crazy. There's nothing about it on the Newport Polo Club website, but I was finally able to find some articles that reference people going to polo matches. And so there's been a lot of things like that. My husband's family is our Newporters from way, way back, from several generations. So we have just all kinds of information. His grandfather was an amateur genealogist, so he's got family trees going way back. Photographs, is my father-in-law was an amateur photographer, but a very good one. So we've got all kinds of photographs of old Newport. So it's really been a combination of books. I recently just reread this. It's The Fall of the Fortune's Children, The Fall of the House of Vanderbilt by Arthur Vanderbilt. Now, I used it extensively in my original research, but, you know, sometimes we read books like this. We're going here and, oh, let me see what, you know, what this chapter tells me about this particular person. So I just recently reread the whole book from cover to cover, which was really a lot of fun and was a nice refresher course. So really, it's just a combination of whatever you can dig up, wherever you can find that little elusive fact. I recently finished the next book in the series and decided to have Emma go to Castle Hill, which is another one of the beautiful homes. This one is along the Ocean Drive, and I hadn't been there in so long, I forgot what it was like inside. So I got in touch with a friend who lives up there, and she said, you know what, I'm going to lunch there in 2 days. I'll take pictures, draw you a diagram and send it on. And so I had all that information, which was amazing.
Both of you have set series either at the end of World War One and into the 1920s. Your Verity Kent series, Anna, and your Lady and a Lady's Maid, Alyssa. What did you find fascinating about that era? And what do you think people who may not be familiar with it would be surprised about it? World War One. Why don't we start with you, Anna?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I initially was drawn to it because in U.S. history classes in like school, World War I was almost the war we skipped over. It was like just this bare blip that we had to get past to get to World War II. And I was always like, wait a minute, isn't there more here? And so when I was an adult, I started reading more about the war, and oh my goodness, there was so much. Especially, it's less impactful in the U.S. because we entered so late, but in Europe and in Britain and in Germany, I mean, it was such a huge impact on them. And, you know, I focus on Britain, so that's what I'm thinking of. But, you know, they lost so many lives. And, you know, I recently was doing research and discovered this village of 1,500 people that lost 50 people between the ages of 20 and 30, 49 men and one nurse. And I mean, like, that's huge, you know? I mean, like, you know these things, but then you, to see that in just this little village, it's such an impact. And it was such a what I've come to understand, it was such a cataclysm. You know, Britain did everything the old school way. The aristocracy was in charge. Everybody followed the season, the social season, and everything. You know, there hadn't been a major war in Europe in over 100 years. All of the major royal houses, they were intermarried and related to each other. I mean, it went this certain way. And then the war, but then there was all these technological advances. And then the war happened, and they were still thinking in that old school mindset, but then facing machine guns who could kill hundreds of men, you know, like in a minute, you know, and, you know, tanks and all these things, airplanes. And, you know, it took them so long to adapt to the fact that things had changed. And then the fact that so many men lost their lives in this horrific conflict that should never have happened. It just changed everyone forever. And there was the lost generation, they really were lost. And, you know, it was to wrap your head around that and to understand the psychology of these people that went through it, even the people on the home front. And there was the propaganda that there was this disconnect between the people in the men in the trenches and the people at home. They had a totally different understanding of how the war had gone. And, you know, there's so much conflict. There's so much of a tragedy to the whole era, you know, to be able to explore that. And it's such the infancy of other things like spying, like the way we think of the modern, you know, CIA, you know, Secret Service, MI6, all of that, it's in that era. And so it's just, as a writer, it's great fodder to work with. It's there's so much conflict and there's so much emotional tragedy and things to work through, and how do you rebuild your life, and, you know, you've kept all these secrets. So it's just captured my imagination to have to tangle with all of that.
Now, what I found compelling about the same era, and the reason I set my Lady and Ladies Made books there, is because I have a fascination with transitional time periods. During the war, even though there was upheaval and people were forced into different roles that they never envisioned for themselves, everybody did have a role. You were a soldier, you were a nurse, you were rolling bandages, you had your assigned place in the world order. You know, maybe you were working in a factory, but as soon as all that ended, people were suddenly left to make their choices. You know, during the war, you didn't have choices. You had to do what needed to be done. But the minute that was over, as Anna just said, a lost generation, these people were lost because everything was different now. The war I saw as a great equalizer because everybody bled the same color. And I learned about a place in Belgium, and the name escapes me, but it was an inn where soldiers would go on leave, and enlisted men and officers left their rank outside, and they ate together and you know, played cards together and prayed together, and there was no saluting inside.
Talbot House. Is it Talbot House in Poperinghe?
Talbot House, yes, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I knew I wouldn't remember it. So this began the blurring, for the first time, really, of class lines. It's not that the aristocracy and the idea of different classes went away. It didn't. Maybe it still hasn't. I don't know. But they just were not as clearly defined as they were before. The wealthy were not as wealthy as they were before, because the war destroyed whatever was left of that agrarian economy of the old estates, really by then was gone. And of course the death taxes took a huge bite out of people's fortunes. So that idea of, you know, now the wealthy have to figure something new out. They can't just sit back in their country estate and expect the profits to roll in off the tenant farms like they did. People were leaving those farms. They were migrating to the cities. Women who were not ever going to find a husband because they had all died during the war were trying to work and support themselves, yet they were called surplus women in a derogatory sense, that they were now these hangers-on in society and very inconvenient, and they were not treated well by the press or by society as a whole, and yet they were struggling to make their own way and to hang on to those jobs that they were supposed to leave when all the men came home. Now, I would say that I take a much lighter approach than Anna. I think, Anna, your series is more traditional mystery, and it really goes deep into the scars, I think, you know, on individuals and on society as a whole. My family, the Renshaws, are living in that village, and it is a bit more, it's more family oriented, I think, is what I'm trying to say. They haven't had the modern world and chewed on them too terribly. And they're trying to preserve what's left of tradition while at the same time trying to readjust and move forward into the coming 20th century.
Both of you have written series. As an author, what are the advantages to writing a series and what are the challenges? And we'll start with you, Anna.
I love writing a series because you get to really explore your characters in depth. I mean, when you're isolated to one book, it's harder to go as deep. Whereas when you can kind of go over a series, you can explore over time and take your time. There's not a rush for them to come to whatever epiphany or to grow as a person or to find, you know, the strength to move on from a tragedy. That's one thing I really love, and I love being able to build up that secondary cast. They're some of the funnest part about the books. I always have my secondary characters always surprise me. There's some that have popped up that I was planning to be a one-off, and they're like, no, I'm not going anywhere. So they give me great ideas. I would say the downfall of a series is that if once you get far into it, sometimes people are hesitant to start because, oh no, I got to read 9 books now. So it's a balance. It's a real balance, especially when you're writing each book, starting it so that the people who've never read your series before aren't lost, but also you're not boring your regular readers to tears in the first chapter or two, just catching everybody up. So that can get tricky and it takes up page space. And yeah, I would say that's really, for me, the only big downfall is just that. Are people willing to jump into that series after you've gotten on farther?
Yeah, but I think most mystery readers are willing to do that. I think when somebody discovers a new series, mystery readers just love series. That's the, you know, general consensus that I've found. So I think they're thrilled to find, oh, wow, there's 9 books in the series, because they will read a book a day or at least a book a week and catch up on those 9 books or whatever, it's really quick. But I also love the evolution of my characters. Emma has done some things, and so have Phoebe and Eva, that I didn't necessarily plan on them doing. And yet the way they've evolved, sometimes you have to listen to your characters. And I feel like as they've evolved, I've evolved as a writer as well. So it's really been a journey for all of us that I've completely enjoyed. And to keep it fresh, there are always those new secondary characters that will pop into every story. I don't think I've ever had any book in either series where there haven't been new characters coming along. So that helps keep it fresh. I think my greatest challenge has been, well, not my greatest challenge, but one of my most fun challenges has been to have a different murder weapon in every book. You know, of course, at least for the first murder, for the initial murder, you know, then the guns and the knives will come out later, but I've really tried to come up with original ways of offing people in every book. That's been fun.
Yeah, especially your new book, it's Murder by Automobile, I guess.
I know. everyone's so happy to see those automobiles, and look what happens.
Both of you have been writing for a while. What do you know now as authors that you wish you had known when you were first starting out? And we'll start with you, Alyssa.
Oh my goodness, just about everything. It's a tough business. It's a, you know, we do the creative stuff and everything about it, everything else about it is just, you know, cut and dried business. It's about numbers. It's about, raising those numbers with each book. I think though, in a good way, one of the things I wish I had known right away was just how wonderful it would be to meet the people that I would meet and have the chance to network with other authors and hear from readers. That's something that I didn't know. You know, I didn't know what a community I was entering when I first started writing. And that's a really fabulous thing. It's probably my favorite thing about writing.
For me, I wish, what I know now that I didn't know was how long everything takes. I mean, most people don't realize how long the publishing industry is, that you turn in a book and it doesn't get published for a year and a half. So I think that's a big part of it. Everything's just so stretched out. But also everything, when I first started out, I was so anxious and you know, I think I know now not to sweat all those small things. That's always the advice I give to newbie authors. I'm like, you know, there's going to be hiccups and there's stuff that's going to go wrong and it's going to seem like everything takes forever and you're going to be impatient. And, you know, you really have to just develop a thick skin and just kind of roll with things and take deep breaths. And, you know, I think I wish that I had been around to tell myself that when I first started, because everything just seemed like such a, you know, so every little thing was so important when it really wasn't.
I would just like to add that I started pre-internet a long time ago. And so I knew how slow things were because you had to mail your manuscript and your query letters and wait for the mail to come back. It was slow.
In both of your books, they're not just mysteries. There's other elements that kind of creep into the story, whether it's a romantic element or things like that. Do you ever get push from your editors to say, stop that and focus on the mysteries? And we'll start with you, Anna.
I do not. I've been really lucky. My editors, I love them to death, and they kind of really give me a lot of freedom. I may get a little more freedom than some authors do, and I'm very grateful to them for that, because I tend to write best when I don't have a lot of restraint, and they let me kind of go places. And there's even times when I'm writing sometimes that I'm like, ooh, maybe I'm going outside the rules a little too far, but then it ends up working out and I love it. And it just worked out better than I ever thought it would. And I don't know, I don't know if I can imagine writing a book that doesn't have like a romance element to it. It just, even a minor one, because it just adds so much to your characters. It gives them a humanity and a depth, and it gives them, you know, more things at jeopardy, and it just rounds them out as a whole. But also, you know, and history, I just love history. So it's like throwing in those different history things, you know, like the One Lady Derby book, I was talking about the trial of the London Burkers, which I found so fascinating to be able to parallel that, was just fun. And I loved it, so I hoped readers would love it. So, yeah.
I know, my editor is fabulous, and I also love him to death. And no, I've never gotten any of that kind of feedback. And I think because I really do keep to a kind of cozy format, I guess you'd call it, that it's expected to have some kind of romance and to have family and friends and issues come up with their private lives. So it's not just the mystery and the solving of the crime.
Alyssa, you're part of a group called Sleuth in Time. Can you tell us a little bit about that cooperative venture?
We are, my goodness, I think we're up to maybe 9 authors now. We just help each other cross-promote our books. We have a Facebook page called Sleuths in Time, and we post daily We usually post things that are either historical in nature or something to do with tea time. Let's see. Anything that we know our readers enjoy discussing or looking at. We also have a book club, which we try to do monthly. We've kind of fallen behind on that with things being what they are right now, but we do a book club, and we usually feature our books, our newest, latest book. But we've also been having discussions about books that we're reading, and we're trying to do a little bit more of that. So that's a lot of fun, and we have good participation in that. And we love getting together when it's possible to actually meet in person. We usually get together at Malice every year, the Malice Convention in Bethesda. And we plan and we talk writing and we just really support each other. Some of our members, I don't know about, me with my blank mind, but Ashley Weaver, Clara McKenna, DE Ireland. Let's see, oh gosh. Oh, Victoria Thompson. Erica Ruth Neubauer. I'm saying that wrong. I'm sorry, Erica, if you're listening. My mind is going blank, but there are about 9 of us. And it's a nice support group too. We also have our own little private page where we can talk about business and lament anything or celebrate anything that's going on in our careers.
Anna, it's been a busy year for you with both your series, but you also kind of branched off in a different direction with an anthology called The Deadly Hours. Can you tell us a little bit about that book and what it was like writing that kind of
story? Yeah, absolutely. It was so much fun to get to team up with other authors because you write in such a vacuum so often. So to be able to collaborate with other authors was just so much fun. The Deadly Hours, I was with Susanna Kearsley and C.S. Harris and Christine Trent. And it's a book about a pocket watch that passes through each of our stories through time. And is it cursed or not cursed? And it seems to be, there seems to be a remarkable coincidence of all these bad things that happen around this watch. Each story, I don't want to give too much away, has a different thing it has to do with the watch, whether it's a curse, whether it's going to break the curse, those kind of things. And it was just a lot of fun to work out all those little connections. We kind of just teamed up. It was initially my idea, and I reached out to Christine, and then we kind of came up with the general idea about, an object that passed through time that might be cursed. And she came up with the pocket watch. And then we reached out to some authors, and Susanna Kearsley and C.S. Harris ended up being our team. And we really just plotted it really tightly, pretty much. We had pages and pages of documents about this and the watch, and we had pictures of all the pieces of the watch, and everybody contributed different parts to it and designing it and just the history of the watch all through time. Even when there's 100 years, I think, between Susanna and my stories, and we still knew where all the places that watch went and where it was wreaking havoc. And so we could kind of use it in our stories. And then we all wrote at the same time, which shocks most people, but we did. We all wrote our stories at the same time. I think C.S. Harris was the last story, and she was the first one done. And Susanna, who's first, was the last one done. And then once we had them all done, we fit them together, we read it straight through, and we really didn't have a lot of adjustments to make, just small things. And we'd left some holes in our, some of us had left little holes in our novella to fill in things that other people had figured out ahead of time. In the stories before that, but it just worked out really great. And then we had a wonderful editor who smoothed out all the edges and everything too, so it was just a lot of fun. I would love to do it again.
Let's switch tracks just a little bit and talk about what you've been reading recently that you might want to share with other readers. Why don't we start with you, Alyssa?
Well, I read A Penny for Your Secrets recently, which was fantastic, and I'm really curious what's going to happen with Ardmore, because I didn't see it coming that he was going to walk off into the sunset at that point. So I highly recommend A Penny for Your Secrets by Annalee Huber. And at the moment, I'm reading, it's not a mystery, it's The London Restoration by Rachel McMillan. Have you read it, Anna?
Yes, it's wonderful.
It's just, it's intriguing. You know, there's spy themes and it's just after World War II. And she creates this whole theme around the churches of London that have been bombed. And it's just fascinating and poetic and beautifully written and just so emotionally deep and wonderful. I'm gushing over it. Rachel, if you're out there listening, I'm gushing. And I love the London Restoration. It's fabulous. I'm also reading, because I always love to read a nonfiction and a fiction at the same time. So this is one of history's mysteries, Searching for Amelia by Rick Gillespie. And I had the extreme pleasure of hearing him talk at a Sleuthfest conference years ago. And that's where I bought this book. And I only now got around to reading it. But it's written in such a way that you think, oh, maybe they're going to find her this time. You know. So even though we know the outcome, it's still very compelling book.
So I just caught up on the Andrea Penrose series, her Rexford and Sloane, which is excellent. And it's so funny, I've been working through my to be read pile, this massive pile, and I'm trying to like dig myself out of a little bit. And I've kind of been on a magic realism kick. I read The Book Charmer by Karen Hawkins recently, and it's really good. If you like, like Sarah Addison Allen, who I adore, that kind of feel. And I am in the middle of reading Midnight at the Blackbird Cafe, which is around the same concept. Heather Weber, I think, is the author's name. But yeah, those are, I highly recommend any of those. And yes, London Restoration was excellent. Like, it just made me want to go to London and visit all the churches. It's just beautiful. So.
Looks like we do have a few questions from your Facebook readers. And the first question, I think you're probably going to hate, because I would hate it if I was an author. The question is, which series do you prefer to write? And we'll start with you, Anna. It's like choosing a child.
Yeah. I don't know that I prefer either. I there's different things I love about both of them. And I love that I get to write two series because I never get tired of them. Because when I'm finishing a book in one series, then I'm excited to start the next one. And so it's a refresh in your mind. It's, I don't know, there's something, I feel really lucky that I get to do that. So I don't know that I have a preference. Maybe Lady Darby's easier just because I've been writing it for longer, but just maybe my smidgen. So
I'm going to say the one that I happen to be writing at the time. It's like asking me, which daughter do I love the most? You know, which are my children? Yeah, like Anna said, there's things I love about both of them. I guess the thing I love the most about writing the Newport books, though, is going there and actually doing the in-person research. And I don't get to do that with the other series because I can't just pop up to England anytime I want. So there's that. And there maybe is a bit more personal connection for me and my family in the Newport series. But I love the characters in both books, and I love the dynamics between them and their families and their secondary characters. So yeah, whichever one I happen to be writing.
The next question is, what does your day look like when you're writing? Why don't we start with you, Alyssa?
My day. Well, I like to start with a leisurely coffee out in my porch with the ceiling fans going to just kind of, you know, wake myself up. I'm not a morning person, so I will tend to kind of play a little bit on the computer before I get going on the writing. But once I start, I'm there. I don't tend to get up for any other reason than to stretch my legs and, you know, maybe even do a little Tai Chi in between things to kind of get me moving again. I do try to, you know, I think exercise is really important for writers because it makes your mind move. I think there's that danger of becoming so sluggish physically that your brain becomes sluggish as well. But I will spend several hours a day between, you know, researching any points that I have to research and actually doing the writing. I do always start off by rereading what I wrote, or a section of what I wrote the day before, to kind of put my mind back into the story and into those characters. And that's pretty much it. I'm not one of those disciplined people that have a business plan and a step-by-step, this is how I do it. I just throw myself into it, and you know, when it flows, it flows.
For me, well, this year's been a little different with the pandemic. I have two young children. So in March, my kindergartner came home from school and didn't go back. So I had to really adjust, because I mean, with the kindergartner, they can't do their remote learning by themselves. So you're kind of doing a little homeschooling. This fall, they have gone back, and it's gone well so far. So my routine's pretty much when my eldest child is in school, my routine is that my husband and I both are working from home right now. So I get my child up, I get her on the bus, and then I get to work, and he takes care of the three-year-old for the morning, and I work until the three-year-old goes down for nap and my six-year-old gets off the bus, and then I have them for the afternoon, which works great for me, because I'm not a morning person, but I write better in the morning. For some reason in the afternoon I get so tired and sluggish, it takes forever to get a thought out. So in the morning, even though I'm tired, once I get going, my brain just goes. So, and I have to have my tea or my coffee. That's really all I need. So just to get going. So
afternoon tea is very important for me. I will add that. Have to have my afternoon tea.
Well, we do have one last question for Anna. It's, what does the sentence, "I love it when a plan comes together," mean to you?
Oh, wow. Well, oh, they're probably getting that from my A-team reference. I'm guessing, because my, isn't that A-team?
I think so.
I was going to say, like, am I mixing these up? As a child, I have a large family, and I have, I'm the second of six children, and my three brothers that are the older brothers and me, we used to play A-team on our parents' riding lawnmower. That was our A-team van. And I was always Hannibal. I don't know why I was the one who was, you know, in charge of the plan. So, you know, I think I would say for me, that talks about my story. Cause like when I'm writing a book, you know, I'm a hybrid writer. I plot, but I like to leave a lot of room to move, to make changes. And so I don't really know whether the plan's going to come together until the very end. And so that quote definitely fits that, because when you finally can see that your book is going to work and that it's all the pieces are going to fit together, it's a glorious feeling and a huge relief. Wouldn't you say, Alyssa?
Yes. What's next for both of you as an author, Alyssa?
I'm writing my seventh, I think it is, Lady and Lady's Maid book right now. I just finished the ninth Newport book over the summer. And I've recently signed contracts for three more in each series after that. So things are going really well. I'm like very happy, very grateful to be in this position.
My next Lady Darby mystery, book nine, A Wicked Conceit, comes out April 6th. And then I am working on Verity Kent book five, Murder Most Fair, which will be out next autumn. So, yeah.
Well, it sounds like you'll be busy, and we have something good to look forward to. I want to thank both Anna and Alyssa for joining us today, and thank you for tuning in to another virtual author program at the Poison Pen Bookstore.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.